Audi.com or 1-800-4-Audi.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Now, what if I were to say 2G4U? That's the number 2, the letter G, the number 4, the letter U. Would they mean anything to you? Well, try too good for you. Or how about GMTA, great minds think alike. In the idiosyncratic universe of online chatter, the acronym, sometimes generously peppered with numbers, is a building block for language. The internet boom of the past decade has sparked revolutions of all sorts, changing the way we get information, the way we do business, the way we find lovers. Well, to hear the linguist David Crystal tell it, the internet has also opened up the possibilities of language. NetSpeak, as he calls it, isn't just communication modified. It's a brand new and valid mode of expression. It's not speech, not really, because it's not spoken. But it's not print either. It's more ephemeral, more adaptable than that. What it is, claims Crystal in his new book, Language and the Internet, is a breakthrough. Now, many language lovers call it blasphemy to the mother tongue they fought so hard to protect. So, Connection listeners, what do you think? Are you one of those people fluent in NetSpeak, or are you deliberately anti-acronym? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK for talk. Try your hand at NetSpeak at theconnection.org if you so choose. David Crystal joins me now from Holyhead, Wales, where he is an honorary professor of linguistics at the University of Wales, Bangor. Welcome, David.
Hello, Nick. Nice to hear you.
Nice to hear from you. I'm interested in knowing whether or not you've crossed over from the written form of communication to NetSpeak. Is that your preferred form of communication now?
Well, I'm a great believer in using everything that's available, you know. I mean, I didn't stop speaking when I learned to write when I was a kid, and I haven't stopped writing now that I've learned to NetSpeak, as it were. I think one of the things about language is that it develops in so many interesting ways. That's one of the reasons why I became a linguist, to try and keep track of all these fascinating changes that are going on. And this latest one, NetSpeak, is just the latest in a long evolutionary trend in language, which is making us communicate in different ways.
Now, we should be specific here, because when you talk about NetSpeak, you're talking about the little yellow happy face that pops up in the middle of an email. You're talking about every tool that's available in form of communication using the computer. Is that right?
Yes, that's absolutely right. It isn't just the little acronyms that you mentioned earlier, or those little smiley figures. It's absolutely everything that happens when somebody sits down at a computer terminal and tries to talk, in inverted commas, to somebody else at another computer terminal. Whether you're sending an email, whether you're accessing a page on the World Wide Web, whether you're joining a chat room, or whether you're playing one of those crazy fantasy games that so many people like to play. Either way, whichever you're using, you've got to devise a technique for communicating. And the old-style speech won't work. You've got to change that. The old-style writing won't work. You've got to change that.
Why doesn't the old-style writing work? I mean, my English teacher would tell me that the shortest sentence, the most concise presentation of a thought, was the best way of getting across an idea, whether it was spoken or in a letter or in what was not known then as an email.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's not that it doesn't work. You can still use the old style writing if you like, and many people do. The thing is, though, that you're able to do other things that traditional writing didn't let you do. I mean, the fundamental difference between writing on the internet and writing outside is that the internet allows you to do things that traditional writing never allowed you to do. For instance, if I send you an email, Dick, it is perfectly possible for you to take that email and now chop it up into little bits. The technique is called framing. You can say you want to respond to the second sentence in my email, but not the first one. So you cut it out and paste it down below, or you just insert your little comment after my second sentence. And then a little further down, you see another sentence you want to react to. So you put your little answer in there. And then you send the whole lot, all cut and paste, back to me. And I see my message snipped up into those bits with your responses, and then I can do the same thing back to you, and indeed I can now copy it to a third party who can put his or her little responses into the email. Now, it was never possible in traditional writing to do that. I mean, in theory, if somebody sends you a letter, you could always get your scissors out and cut the sentences up into little bits and answer, but nobody, of course, would do that. On the internet, it's perfectly possible to do that in an email, with the bonus that at the end of the day, the email you send looks as perfect as the email email you receive, because it's all in that nice, neat typeface, you see. This is something that traditional writing never allowed you to do. The internet is a much more dynamic, interactive mechanism.
Now, it's also in many ways different because a lot of the rules don't work there. The rules of capitalizing at the beginning of sentences or using hyphens or series of dots, anything that you have at your fingertips that allows you to make the message that you're sending to whoever you're sending a message to seem more like conversation, less like a written missive, right?
That's exactly right. That's one of the reasons why you've developed, but people have developed in such an amazing short time. You know, most of us have only been online in this way for a few years, have developed these new styles. One of the reasons for the style is simply the speed of the process. When I send you an email, I am typing very fast. And the important thing is I get my message out. You can divide people into two types. Those people who insist that when their message goes out, it is perfectly correct in all its traditional capitalization and punctuation and everything, and then the others who don't care at all. So long as the message gets across, that's all that matters. And the interesting thing is this. If I receive an email from you and it's got no capital letters in it or no punctuation or a spelling mistake, I don't say to myself, oh, Dick Gordon can't spell or Dick Gordon doesn't know how to punctuate. I simply say, Dick Gordon's sending me an email and he's in a hurry and he's made a few mistakes, but so what? I recognize them as mistakes and I might send the same mistakes back. Now, these things are things we accept in an internet transmission, which we would never accept, of course, outside the context of the internet. And that's what makes it so interesting. This proves the point that internet language is very different from traditional language as used elsewhere.
But as if it doesn't use the rules that were taught to us all in a grade 3 grammar class, it does bring with it its own new set of rules, right?
Yes, you have to have rules all the time, otherwise language is going to break down. And it isn't the case that there are no rules. In fact, actually, dropping punctuation doesn't actually make much difference for most of the communications we send to each other. Remember, punctuation came along in the history of language relatively late. It was only in the 18th century that punctuation really settled down to the system that we know today. But to take an example of a new kind of rule, the rule that you shouldn't put your message into capital letters throughout unless you really want to express some sort of anger or emotion. You mentioned at the very beginning in the trail for the program, come and flame the prof. Well, flaming, you see, is a very good example. Flaming is when you're shouting at somebody through the email. You're getting angry. You're letting your emotions run away with you. And if you want to signal that, you put the message in capital letters. And if you do put your message in capital letters, you will convey the impression that you are shouting. And this means that, I mean, I remember a few weeks ago, I got a message from somebody who obviously didn't know how to use the email system yet. He was new to it. And he just got he thought it was sensible to send his entire message in capital letters. He just had his capital key pressed on his keyboard and everything came across in capital letters. The effect, of course, was overpowering. I thought this guy was really furious with me. And of course, he wasn't at all. And that's a little rule you have to learn, that you don't use capital letters unless you mean to shout.
But I guess what I'm getting at is if there are a whole new set of rules that are evolving for the way that we communicate using the computer, isn't it just as likely, David, that 5 years from now, the grade 3 class teacher is going to say, all right, sit down. Now we're going to learn how to send a business email and a personal email. And we're simply going to adapt the rules of communication to something like this, which to me makes me think we're not necessarily on the brink of the biggest language revolution ever, which is what you're saying.
Ah, well, now this is undoubtedly going to happen, that just as children get to school and they are taught there that they must now learn to write in a style that is different from the way they speak, because writing has certain conventions and it's for a different sort of purpose, and it takes them a few years to learn that. Well, this is already happening in some schools around the globe. I was, in fact, observing a class at work here in Britain a little while ago where the kids, this was a group of kids at about age 9, were already getting some training of the sort that we've just been talking about and learning, as it were, a new style in their language repertoire. Of course, the teacher didn't have to teach them very much in the sense that the kids were already more advanced in that method of communication than I am, actually. But no, this isn't what I mean when I say it's a revolution. When I say that the internet is a revolution in language, what I mean is it's making us do things like we never ever did before. Now, the example we've been using so far isn't the perfect example. There are better examples, and here are two, if I've got time to say them. The first one is that in a chat room, we talk to each other. Now, in the history of human communication, it's only really been possible to have a conversation with one person at a time. If I go to a cocktail party and there are 100 people in the room, there are 50 conversations going on, I can really only pay attention to one conversation at a time. Maybe the one next door to me if I notice something, but you certainly couldn't pay attention to all of them. Now, as soon as you enter a chat room, there might be 100 people around the globe all talking in the same chat room, and they're all sending messages which are all scrolling down your screen in front of your eyes, and you can now respond to any one of those sub-conversations that are taking place on the screen in front of you. If you really are on the ball, and some chat room enthusiasts certainly are, you can have 10, 12, 20 conversations going on at the same time, sort of juggling all these conversational balls in the air, as it were. Now, never in the history of human communication has it been possible to carry on 20 conversations simultaneously. That's what I mean when I say the internet is allowing us to do something that's fundamentally different.
David, just stand by because we've got a chat room participant on the line with us. Debbie's calling in from Westboro. Debbie, you spend a lot of time in chat rooms?
From time to time I do over the years, yes.
How is it affecting the way that you communicate?
Well, in the old days, I wrote many letters, and I often tried to write as I spoke. I would use shortcuts, like if I was going to say, I don't know, I would spell it D-U-N-N-O, or I'll let you know, L-E-T-C-H-A.
Right.
I do that so much more in chat rooms now, and I considered myself an excellent speller with excellent grammar, and I find myself now so used to this casual type fast like I speak, I have trouble now going to write a proper letter. I think my proper spelling and grammar has suffered. It's not so automatic anymore.
Does that bother you?
Yeah, it does. And as a matter of fact, I'll go into certain chat rooms where I've known people for years, and until you get to know someone, if you make a typo, many times you go back and you put a little asterisk and you say, you know, you respell it to show that I know how to spell this word correctly.
Right.
And, you know, my favorite thing is, don't worry, I speak fluent typo. But, you know, it's almost like you still want to show the person you know how to write properly, and you constantly correct yourself until you're in a comfort zone where people will let you just make those typos and continue on, or type sloppily with no capital letters and continue on.
David Kristol, this sounds like someone who's caught between the old and the new here.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I think there are lots of people like Debbie around the world, and I feel that way myself sometimes. It's all so recent, you see. We're in the middle of a transition. You know, there were really no chat rooms a few years ago. It's all happened so recently. And whenever a new kind of language situation arrives, we all feel a bit uncomfortable until it settles down. It's going to take a few years before it settles down. And in the meantime, people will not know how to behave. Now, there are some chat rooms which certainly take the sort of situation that Debbie's described, where you have to, you know, they expect you to behave in a certain way until they get to know you. And then there are others which are actually much more accepting of variation right from the outset. I think the point she makes, that it can affect your writing elsewhere, is something indeed you have to watch. It happens all the time. When children learn to write in school, it sometimes affects the way they speak, and the teachers have to say, use both, kids. It's not one or the other.
Debbie, thanks for your call. Our telephone number, 1-800-423-8255. Is it a revolution? Are we in the middle of something which we can't define, or are we watching something new take shape as every time we touch our keyboard? 1-800-423-8255 is the telephone number to join The Connection. My name is Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. This is The Connection on National Public Radio. My name is Dick Gordon. We're talking this hour with David Kristol about the language legacy of online chatter, NetSpeak. Now, Connection listeners, what do you think? Is it a viable medium? Our number's 1-800-423-8255. And we're joined on the line now by John McWhorter, who's Associate Professor of Linguistics at the University of California, Berkeley. He is a specialist in language change, language contact, pidgin and Creole. His latest book is called Power of Babel, A Natural History of Language. Hello, John.
Hi.
You've been listening to us talk about this NetSpeak thing. Do you see it, in fact, as a like a third mode of communication.
Yeah, it is, although while I'm a great fan of email and the internet, and I know they're not going away, I don't think of them as a terribly encouraging development. I think of them as something that we're stuck with rather than something to celebrate or as something that is mesmerizingly dynamic or the like. And that's because it is a third way of communicating. What it is it's situated in between the spoken style and the written style. And around the world and throughout history, spoken language is relatively choppy and relatively loosely structured. And then there's an art which certain people around the world have developed, which is the written. And the written is less spontaneous. You have time to plan it, and so your structure tends to become more sophisticated. Your vocabulary is larger and more subtle. And they're kind of two different ways of using language. The internet and email are in between because you are writing in the technical sense, but you are often being spontaneous. You often don't have time to check what you write, and there's a kind of a face-to-face intimacy which encourages a certain speed and a certain vibrancy. But the problem with this is something which the caller highlighted beautifully, which is that I think that the internet is eating into our ability to write on the level that we used to. And some people may feel that that's not terribly important and that history marches on. Some people may feel that this is a decline. But I find myself thinking of very mundane things. If you look at the letters that really mundane grunt soldiers wrote home during the Civil War, very ordinary people, it's in a kind of a cut glass prose which their equivalents could almost never approximate today. Writing, that skill, was prized in that America, not just for the elite. And as you look at the development of America, particularly over about the past 35 years, you see that that skill is declining in the population sharply. And I think that this new way of using language is eating into that and encouraging that trend.
Not, David, as David's suggesting, something that could or should be celebrated then.
Yeah, I would not. I'm not one to walk around shaking my fist at things that aren't going away and that have some good points. But I do think that this is not something to celebrate. If anything, we can comment on it. But I don't think that it's a very cute development in any way.
David.
Well, hi, and first of all, can I say hello to John?
Yes, indeed.
Who I've never met, but coincidentally, I'm just reading your Power of Babel book at the moment. It's on my desk right now.
Well, you know, David, that's wonderful. I really love your books, too.
For the British publisher. They just sent it to me just before Christmas, it's
British
nice to talk to you.
You too.
Well, you know, the word celebrate has actually been put into my mouth here by a lot of people. I don't actually use the word myself, really, except in the sense that I like to celebrate all manifestations of language in the sense that I'm fascinated by them.
Right.
And want to explain what's going on and to describe them and all that sort of thing. And it is the novelty of what's happening that has attracted my attention and caused me to write the book in the first place. I don't actually make a judgment in the book as to whether the internet is a good thing or a bad thing. I leave that up to sociologists and psychologists and others. And so I'm keep a fairly open mind about the future of the situation.
But except, David, you do want to challenge the people who simply go to the default position that everything that doesn't conform to proper English on the internet is somehow a bad thing. So,
I mean, that's right. I certainly want to do that because I think there is a knee-jerk reaction to any new form of language, whether it's technology mediated or not, which is a bad thing. There is a purism deep within an awful lot of people,
yes,
which can be very stultifying and antagonistic to the development of language.
That's definitely true, and I've learned a lot about that from David's work himself. And I make a certain difference. In speech, I myself have at this point written a couple of books which argue against the idea that new developments in speech are a bad thing. That's indeed a misimpression that the public understandably tends to labor under. But the differentiation that I make is that there's an extent to which writing is an art. Therefore, it's something that one has to learn in school, that one has to really work hard to get good at. And when the change in question is that in the written medium, people are taking less care and are working in that new medium to such an extent that it eats into their ability to write a letter on paper or to write a composition, that's where I find myself less sanguine and less inclined to just say, well, this is where the language is going. Although, once again, railing against it is pointless, mm-hmm. but I'm just less enthusiastic.
Mind you, there are some pretty exciting developments now. You see, I would react to that by saying it's probably too soon to see the potential of the internet being used to develop really sophisticated forms of written expression. But it's beginning to happen. I'm beginning to see poems and novels written for the internet using the medium, as it were, to its greatest potential. I mean, a feature that's fascinating is the fact that the internet screen can make language mobile. It can animate language. You can use color and things like that, which you can't do in traditional written expression. This is an amazing potential source of sophisticated literary expression, it seems to me, though it's hardly been used yet. I see a potential here for development.
That's definitely true, and I'll just toss this out, and I hope not to seem to be making arbitrary judgments. I wonder if the new conventions that are going to arise on the internet are going to be as inherently tricky and nuanced as the ones that we used to have to observe in written prose, such as the man who I saw yesterday, the man who was not the one I expected, saw, etc., etc. In one of those cases, we're taught to use a comma, and another, we're taught not to. It's kind of tough to master. Things like that. I wonder if we're going to find things that really will require the schoolmarm to beat them into us, as opposed to things that are relatively intuitive and rather fun. And that's a genuine question, but the nuance is what I wonder if we're going to see again.
Well, I think one of the things that's happened in the internet in the last 5 years, I would say, is that the range of people using it has become much more a reflection, a cross section of the people in society. Originally it was just the geeks, I guess,
and
these people were so cool and they thought it was great to get rid of all the old rules and so on.
True.
Now there are people at all ages and of all backgrounds and of all attitudes to language too. So I mean, I'm one. I'm quite sure of the people who, of whom there are quite a large number, who, when I send an email, I make sure my commas are in the right place. That's just me, and it's my age and my background and so on and so forth. I think as the internet grows and more people come online, we will get a much wider representation of language which is partially nuanced and partially non-nuanced. At the moment, I think we're in a transitional period, and we're not getting a fair, as it were, picture of the potential of the medium to cope with all this sort of variation.
1-800-423-8255 put you in this conversation. To Newton now. John's on the line. Hi, John.
Hi. I think it's interesting to look at a similar phenomenon going on in speaking, in the language we use to talk to each other. And if we have something important and thoughtful to say, we can say it to each other verbally just as easily as typing it on the internet if we're lucky enough to have internet access. But it takes time to learn using any medium, typing or speaking. It takes time to learn to communicate meaningfully in a community. And it takes years of experience unless you grow up with that and you're encouraged in different fora, in different forums and places to do that. So an interesting question I would pose is, what forms of communication on the internet that actually encourage meaningful discussions, and what forms just encourage hi, what time are you free? Okay, we'll meet at 8. See you then.
Right, or the sort of gratuitous back and forth that you sometimes find in chat rooms, right?
It seems to me that a lot of what goes on in chat rooms or on news groups is a more urgent kind of communication that involves exchange of information than the kind of greetings that you have on email. One might say that as often as not, especially over the past 5 or 6 years when email has spread or democratized or what have you, that it's the same variety of language that you see used in both of those situations. From what I've seen, the way people talk to each other on lists and in chat groups is pretty much the same in the qualitative sense as people's office memos saying, hello, where's the coffee, and, you know, the toilet stopped up or something like that. That's just my impression.
Yeah, mine is that plus something else. I spent quite a lot of time lurking in different chat rooms when I was preparing that section of the book. And one of the things I found was, yes, there are exactly the sorts of things that John McCourt has just been talking about. But at the other extreme, there are, in fact, some very sophisticated discussions taking place out there. I remember observing a classroom interaction which had been used in a school somewhere in Texas, I think, and the whole set of lessons had been structured on using a chat room environment because some people couldn't make the classes at a particular time and so on and so forth. And in fact, the contributions that were there were a bit like sort of mini essays that people were writing to each other. They were expressing themselves at some length. The paragraphs were quite long, you know, 10 lines, 12 lines and so on. Mm-hmm. And so it is possible for the medium to develop in that direction if the people wanted to.
It seems like there's another tendency, which is to encourage kind of internet kibbling or needling, just making small comments. And this is done verbally all the time too, where one person proves that he's superior to the other by making a better little joke or kind of joking insult or something, as opposed to encouraging in conversation or in chat rooms kind of meaningful discussion where well thought out ideas about reality are given the most respect.
John, thanks a lot for your call. I want to also take this opportunity to thank John McWhorter for being with us. John, thanks again.
My pleasure.
John McWhorter, Associate Professor of Linguistics at the University of California, Berkeley, author of The Word on the Street, Fact and Fable About American English, and most recently, The Power of Babel, A Natural History of Language. 1-800-423-8255 to continue the conversation. Another John is on the line from South Berwick, Maine. Hi, John.
Oh, hi. Gee, thanks for taking my call. Very quickly, I'm sorry John McWhorter had to leave because I think my question related more to his comments, but the professor from Wales probably can pick this up. My concern, and it draws on the idea of the slovenliness that's evident in this mode of communication as compared to traditional modes of written and spoken communication. Is this contributing to ethical and moral breakdown in the culture?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, who knows where it's going to lead? But every time a new technology has come on board in recent history, I mean, you know, from the 15th century, people have thought it was going to be awful. The prophets of doom have come out. When writing was put into print, people said printing was an invention of the devil.
Yes.
Because, you know, when the telephone was invented in the 19th century, people said, oh, it's going to be the breakdown in society because people will stay at home and never meet each other. When broadcasting came along in the 1920s, people said, oh, this is a disaster because it would mean propaganda would get into all our homes. And now the internet, because it does indeed allow this kind of very casual approach to language, people think it's going to spread and knock the rest of language into a hole somewhere.
Right.
But if I go back to what McWhorter was saying, though, David, excuse me for interrupting, is that you need the original proper tools in language use first, and then you get to break the rules. That the danger, and perhaps this is what John is referring to as well, is that if you never have the proper tools of expression in the first place, and you learn to communicate in a chat room, then you just think
then
that
indeed.
There's...
Yeah.
That's a key point.
Yeah, if that happened, then indeed we would be in a very different world of language communication. But that isn't going to happen because schools aren't going to go away. Kids are going to see their internet role alongside the other roles that the teaching of speaking and writing are going to maintain. I don't see this as being a replacing exercise at all. I see it as being a supplementing exercise. I like to take the analogy of buying clothes, you know. I mean, in my wardrobe, I've got some very posh clothes. Don't use them very often, I suppose, but they're there when I need them. And I've got some not so posh clothes and so on. Now, say I go out to the shops and I bring back some really cool, very, very casual clothes. In fact, this makes all my other clothes that I previously thought had been casual actually look rather formal. And now I've got an extra thing in my wardrobe, which I can use on occasion. It doesn't mean to say that I throw all the others away. Very few people would throw all the others away. It simply broadens my clothes repertoire. And now I like to see the language situation as a bit like that. The internet has come along and given us an even more colloquial style, slovenly, if some people like to call it that, but I just like to think of it as an even more casual form of communication than we had existing previously.
But let's go back to whether or not it's something that's brand new, because it's the same David Crystal inside the posh new shirt or the worn old shirt, and what you're saying is in fact, that the language is something valid, is something... which we haven't really acknowledged so far, that it is just a new style.
Yeah, well, I mean, if David Crystal goes out in some of these really casual clothes, some people might say, is that really David Crystal? I mean, I can't believe that he would. And you know, there is this business of being a persona using language. There are certain styles that I would never dream of using because it's just not me. But the point is that the internet allows you a much wider range of choice in language than previously was the case, and it does enable you to do things with language that you were never able to do before, like this business of talking to lots of people simultaneously or framing emails in different ways. Or to take another example, which we haven't talked about today yet, the fact that the language on the screen is so versatile, so mobile in its various ways. One of the big things about written language, you know, Dick, is that it's permanent. If I have a book and I open it at page 10 and I close that book, and then I open it again at page 10 a couple of minutes later, it's the same page 10. You'd be very surprised if that page 10 had changed in some way. Now, go to a World Wide Web page and call that up, and then call it up again 5 minutes later, it might have changed. Something might have happened to it. It might have been refreshed. Indeed, while you're looking at a web page, and remember, we are talking about the web as well as email and everything like that, it can change in front of your very eyes. Colors can come flashing at you. Things can come in from left field and all the rest of it. And this means that we're dealing here with a completely new phenomenon, which has never happened before. And so this means that these clothes, if you like, that have come in, I have to learn not just to wear, I have to learn how to use them to best effect. And that's what makes it different.
1-800-423-8255. Susan from Boston, you're on The Connection. Hi, Susan, are you there? I think we've lost Susan. So while we just get our telephone lines back in order, a quick final question to you, David. I mean, it's the form that changes as well, because as you point out, paragraphs become a line or two long.
The form is immensely flexible. Most people who are communicating using email and chat rooms are doing, as John McWhorter was saying earlier on, and others, they need quick communication. In fact, if you carried on your whole life like that, it would get extremely boring. And some chat rooms are like that, I guess, and some of the game situations are like that. But others realize this very quickly, and they want to get on to serious topics. And so the thing is that you have to do it as quickly as you can, but nonetheless, the medium allows you to develop paragraphs of some sophistication if you want to.
All right, Connection listeners, doing it as quickly as you possibly can, is it a new way of doing it? Can you manage the serious topics? Are we talking about a revolution in the way that we talk to each other? Our telephone number, 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. You're listening to The Connection on National Public Radio. You're listening to The Connection on National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. And my author is David Crystal. He's written a book called Language and the Internet. We're talking about his concept of the language that we use on the web and in emails and chat rooms, something he's named as NetSpeak and what that means to you. We're going to Dublin, Ireland now. David's on the line. Hello, David.
Hello. How are you doing?
Thanks for calling in.
Okay. Earlier, I don't actually believe it was the author who's there, but you had another guest from UC Berkeley who was commenting on the ongoing process of conventions that are being developed for communications on the net. And, you know, there was some speculation about what will happen, you know, say in the next 5 years.
Right.
Particularly with respect to the importance of punctuation and things. And the point, actually, that I'd like to make is that those conventions already exist, although there is a great mass of people that are ignorant of them.
Give me an example of what you mean.
Well, a very common one, it has to do with the way that people reply to emails. Okay. In Usenet, which is essentially a large shared email forum, there is a convention that you break down a message that you're responding to into each piece that you're responding to, sort of each point as you go, and that you maintain the context of the point that you're responding to. Whereas a lot of people that I met who are coming online, say, in the last 2-3 years, they just, like, write their whole message and then leave the old message at the bottom of the mail that they've sent you, which makes it very hard to correlate in an ongoing discussion.
But isn't that just part of us all learning the new system, David, that there are people who are in there, you know, who are just coming to the net for the first time, and within a year or two, they're going to figure that out because they're going to get fed up with the same kind of garbage you're looking at.
Well, that may be. I think that's likely, although the fact is that standards do exist right now. There are ways that people actually do these things that have been worked out that work well for people that use email every day. I mean, I deal with 60 to 70 messages a day sometimes, okay? And these conventions actually make it work for me, because without them, I would just be swamped in the quantity of email I have to deal with.
Once again, it's the rules, David.
Absolutely. The thing is, they do exist. It's just so many people are ignorant of them, and I don't know how to go about disseminating them, but to present this impression that the Internet is this largely unstructured medium of communication, I think presents the wrong impression.
Something for the school curriculum, David Crystal.
Yes, well, in my chapter on emails in the book, I very much take up these points that David from Dublin has been making. Yes, there is an evolving system of rules out there. The one thing I would say is that there are a few more variations in the approach than he perhaps is suggesting. He's obviously developed a particular method that works for him, and an awful lot of people do work exactly like he says. But on the other hand, you know, there are other systems out there where people will structure the email in a somewhat different way. And in fact, I was able to find 3 or 4 different ways of structuring email interactions, which I refer to in the book. Now, I don't know which one is going to win, as it were, you know, in a few years' time. But it certainly is the case that email, after all, has been around for 25 years or so, although for most of us, we've only known about it in the last decade or even 5 years.
See, I'm not sure that anything will ever win, David, because also, as you describe in the book, the Internet is a place where people like to rebel a little bit. They give themselves a nick or a nickname, and they write in a way that they wouldn't normally write, and they like to be different, and they like to always, you know, mix things up a little bit.
Well, that's how it was. See, that's how it was when it started, because the geeks started it off. The guys who invented the Internet were the first to use it, and they were so cool in the language they used, and they invented all these various things. And then a young population came and took it over, and the Internet used to be indeed a very young person's medium. But the studies of Internet use that have been done in the last few years are showing that the average age is creeping up and up and up.
Right.
And although I'm, you know, I must sound over the radio, you know, in my early 20s, I hope. But in actual fact, I'm just a teenager. But I passed 60 last year, and I'm not one of the youngest on the Internet by any means. I mean, I know people of 70 or 80 years of age.
Right.
Now, these are people who are not using nicknames and who are not twisting the language in the way the youngsters do. And so what's happening is that as the Internet becomes used by more and more people, a wider range of styles is taking place, and the thing is settling down, as it were. I think in 10 years' time, it'll have settled down an awful lot compared to what it is at the moment.
David from Dublin, thank you for your call to Buffalo, New York, where John has shoveled enough snow away from his telephone to give us a call. Hi, John.
Oh, it's just sitting on top of the snowbank, actually.
All right.
I have something I'd like Dr. Crystal to comment on. It's an observation I've made, and it's not that astute, perhaps, but I spend a fair amount of time on the Internet. And I speak with people from Finland and Denmark and Japan and India and you name it. And the literary, or rather the linguistic, coin of the realm is English. I'm wondering if we're not seeing English evolving into a true international language, and if we might not be generating some new dead languages over the next few decades.
Well, now, this is a very interesting point. Thanks for that. Because my impression is, thankfully, as a linguist, quite the reverse. The facts of the matter are these, that when the Internet started, some decades ago, it was indeed 100% English language, because it started in the United States, and then it was taken up by people who are predominantly English language speakers around the world. But since that time, as other countries have come online, other languages have come online. And when I started to write my book in 1999, the Internet was down to about 80% or 75% English. And this year, It's down to less than 70%, maybe approaching 65%. And I went to a conference last year where there was a chap from Alta Vista, one of the search engine companies, who was predicting, his company was predicting that by the end of 2003, the internet would be 50% English. Now, he may be right, he may be wrong, but the general message is very clear, that as the internet is taken up by more and more countries, more and more languages are coming online. And when I was writing my book, I went out and tried to count them all. And I counted and counted and counted and got to 1,000 languages and decided life was too short to carry on. There must be at least 1,500 languages on the internet now. That's a quarter of the world's languages. You know, there are about 6,000 languages in the world at the moment. At least a quarter of them have an internet presence.
Go ahead, John.
One point where I might differ with Mr. Crystal, or Dr. Crystal, I'm sorry, is that while these languages are on the internet, if you want to speak in the language of Belarus, you certainly can. If you wish to join the global conversation, the one where the most populous group is, it's going to be English. If you want the most web hits on your page, you do it in English. And certainly a lot of pages have multiple languages. You can get it in German and or English. But
John, have you experimented with any of these programs that actually will translate things for you?
Oh, I've used Babelfish and a few of those, and you know, it's good for doing an individual email, but it's not very speedy.
Yeah, this is a function of the recency of the phenomenon, really. I mean, it is the case, as you rightly say, that English is the dominant language of the internet, and most of the content that's out there is in the English language, and it'll stay that way for quite a while. But, you know, this is only a function of the fact that some of the other major languages in the world haven't got online yet. I mean, only 3% of the population of South America is online. Well, you know, Spanish is one of the world's fastest growing languages. And it means that when more people get online in South America and Central America, suddenly there'll be vast more Spanish content than used to be the case. But, you know, you mentioned this business of dying languages, and one of the things that does my heart good is to see the way in which some of these virtual speech communities are growing up around the world. In other words, you have a language which is in danger of becoming extinct. And the number of people who speak it, there might only be a few hundred, but they're scattered all over, say, the United States. Now, traditionally, they wouldn't have been able to talk to each other. On the web, they can produce a chat room, and suddenly you get a virtual speech community where people are now making come alive again a language that was in danger of dying out. So I see the internet as being a force for potential good here, notwithstanding the fact that English is still the dominant voice.
All right, John, thank you for your call. 1-800-423-8255. And we're going to Stephen, Cambridge. You're on The Connection.
Hi, this is Stephen. I'm in a car phone in Cambridge.
Yeah, go ahead, Stephen.
It just occurred to me in listening to your conversations that this may all be moot in a year or two, because I envision us going to a kind of Star Trek form where we don't type anything on a keyboard any longer, but the normal way of delivering information is to speak it, and then some algorithm converts it to some written form that somebody else will form a convention on to make it appear in script.
It's already there, though, Stephen. I mean, not in conventional use, but...
I understand it exists, but I would assume or presume that that may become the norm. Typing onto a keyboard in general may
right.
become an archaic form. And, you know, you can make your comments off the air. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Stephen. David.
Yeah, well, it's going to happen, but not as soon as you might expect. Yes, at the moment it is possible, if I speak rather carefully and in a standard accent, for the software to turn my voice into symbols and transmit them and so on and so forth. But, you know, anything resembling the kind of colloquial, fast conversation we're having now is absolutely out of the question. The techniques of speech analysis and synthesis are simply not up to coping with this kind of thing. It's going to take a generation or so before typing becomes history and we start to talk to each other over the internet. It will happen, but it's going to be further off than we think.
But Stephen does, though, point to one of the difficulties that you face in writing the book, David, and that is picking any one point in time and saying this is a new language or this is a new, I should say, rather a new form of communication, when you know that by the time the book's ink is drying, something will have changed, something in chapter 4 will be out of date.
Oh, Dick, this scared the living daylights out of me when I was writing the book. You know, I've written dozens of books in my time, and this is the only one where I've basically said at the end of the book, in front of the bibliography of all the references there, you know, don't trust this bibliography, because by the time you buy the book, half the sites might be off, you know. I mean, this is such a scary thing. The thing is, has changed so much. You know, you get these 404 messages so often, don't you, when you use the web, you know, page no longer available.
Yeah.
And I fear that that indeed this is one of the books I've written, which is going to be, as you say, out of date almost as soon as it was published. But on the other hand, it was important to publish it even as a sort of snapshot of how the internet is at the beginning of the decade of the new millennium.
Time for one quick call. Kate's calling in from Greenville, North Carolina. Hi, Kate.
Hi. One of the things that concerned me is that you're talking primarily about the grammar and et cetera, but I teach on the internet, and I end up with emails from students that are either way too long with no breaks, and so I have to print them out to figure out how one question fits into another question, or they assume because I'm faceless that I can read their minds, and so they don't express themselves very clearly, and then I have to waste time, you know, answering a question. It takes a long time to answer some of these questions. I teach programming.
And is it a laziness, Kate, that you're describing?
I don't think so. I don't think it's laziness. I think that it is an assumption. It's like one of the problems we've had before is sometimes you can't tell if you're addressing a male or a female based on their name. And it's the same kind of thing. You can't tell who the other person is. And it's almost like you're writing to yourself.
Let me ask David about that, because, I mean, really, it's where we began, David. If the whole purpose of the exercise in communication is to make ourselves understood and this isn't working, what's wrong?
Yeah, well, what's wrong is unfamiliarity with the medium. I mean, this makes my point more powerfully than anything else I've said today, I think, that we are dealing here with a new medium, and the evidence that it's new is that people don't know how to handle it. They think that all they've got to do is just speak, as it were, through their fingers and everything will be fine, or write as they used to do and everything will be fine. And what Kate has just pointed out very clearly is absolutely right, that everything is not fine. You've got to learn how to use the medium. And the sooner that property, that NetSpeak and the whole business of internet communication gets into schools at an early age, and teachers who are expert in this start showing children how to communicate using this medium, how to make the best use of it, how to avoid some of these errors of lack of understanding and so on, the better. And then we'll see a great step forward in the history of human communication, I think.
David, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
David Crystal is the author of a book called Language and the Internet. He is honorary professor of linguistics at the University of Wales, Bangor, and author, author of Language and the Internet. Kate, thank you for your call. Earlier in the program, we talked with John McWhorter. He's an associate professor of linguistics at the University of California, Berkeley, and author of Power of Babel, A Natural History of Language. Connection listeners, brush up your NetSpeak. Go to our website. You'll find us at theconnection.org. We had help with our program today from Sarah Manoogian, Tim Monroe, Brian Myers, and Carl Volker. Our program is produced by Sean Carberry, Sarah Field, Kelly Jones, Allison McAdam, Lindsay Miller, Tara Murphy, Christina Rousseau, and Doug Sugart. Lisa Chow is our intern. Our senior producer is Graham Smith. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.